It's been another wild, confusing week for energy producers who are trying to remain profitable. I'm Joy Palacios from Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, and I'm this week's guest host on Fronteras, a public radio collaboration that brings you stories about the U.S.-Mexico border region and the Southwest. The unpredictability continued this week as the price of oil dropped below $50 a barrel and then rose again. The oil refinery strike spread to 15 sites, becoming the largest strike of its kind in 3 decades. The Saudi Arabian oil minister told reporters the demand for oil is going to climb, implying the price would go up too. At the same time, U.S. stockpiles are reportedly at the highest level ever since 1982. Oklahoma-based Chesapeake Energy became one of the latest producers to announce cutbacks. It's slashing its budget by 26%. So who will survive this roller coaster ride? Jim Crane is an oil expert at Rice University's Baker Institute in Houston.
So companies that are small and indebted right now are those that are probably in the biggest trouble. So if you're, if you need to have a certain oil price to pay your debt, your debt service every month, and you're not getting that, well, that's a big problem for you. If you're a larger company with deep pockets, you can afford to, to ride this out, for a few months or even a few years. That said, smaller companies tend to be those in the shale plays. Barriers to entry are pretty low, so you can get in with a small crew and a relatively small investment, and the barriers to exit are also pretty low. So the smaller companies can act a little bit more nimbly than some of the big ones, and some of the big companies, they tend to invest in big projects, and they don't have the same ability to turn it off and on when prices change.
As the price of crude oil dropped, thousands of people lost their jobs in the oil fields of Texas and New Mexico. Oil field equipment theft has always been a problem, but now investigators say laid off and disgruntled employees stealing oil, tools, piping, and copper wire are making it worse. Marfa Public Radio's Lauren Matalon has more.
Oil field theft's not a new problem, but thousands of people in the oil business are losing their jobs right now.
They live paycheck to paycheck.
That's Midland County, Texas Sheriff Gary Painter driving past an oil well.
They don't have a means of getting enough money to get out of here to move out whenever they get laid off, so they go to stealing. And that's what we're looking at right now.
Painter's office is part of the FBI-led Oil Field Theft Task Force in Midland, Texas. That's the historical epicenter of boom and bust in what's still the nation's highest producing oil field, the Permian Basin of Texas and New Mexico.
We're averaging about $400,000 to $800,000 a month in theft.
That includes tools, valves, and pumps that police say are easy to pawn. And that's just here in the U.S. Until oil's price fall, international investors, and as it turns out, Mexican organized crime, were getting ready to extract oil in the largely untouched shale fields of northern Mexico.
We've had contact from people out of Mexico right across the border in Chihuahua State. We have a large amount of equipment that's stolen in the Permian Basin area that is going south across the border. We've caught a lot of stolen stuff going across.
I'm unloading into these tanks here.
We caught up with oil field worker Mark Johnson as he unloaded oil from his truck into the matrix of pipelines that carries crude from Texas to other states. He says theft is part of the landscape, and he says it takes place whatever the price of oil.
People got to eat, so they're doing. I'm not saying it's right. It's definitely not right. It's wrong.
Another worker, John Myers.
When you lose your jobs, you got to find some ways to get money, and it's hard to make money around here without being an oil field.
Several years ago in Washington, D.C., an FBI agent presented statistics about theft in the oil patch to his superiors. The result was the creation of a task force in 2008, headquartered in Midland, dedicated solely to oil field theft. It's the only such unit in the country. The team leader is FBI Supervisory Agent Troy Murdoch.
I can tell you that I'm not slowing down any.
1 month ago, Murdoch's team won a conviction that brought the weight of federal law onto a defendant who otherwise might have only been charged with a state crime. The defendant pleaded guilty to stealing oil multiple times. When someone crosses from one state to another with stolen oil, that's a violation of the laws governing interstate commerce, and that's a federal crime. So in this case, the FBI convinced the court that the act of stealing oil itself implied the oil would be placed in a pipeline that sends oil to other states.
We didn't have to prove that that guy actually went and hooked up the line to the drop area where it actually went into interstate commerce. With this precedent that's been set, it will make it easier for my investigators and eventually, once the word gets out, squash some of the activity that's going on.
Oil field theft isn't confined to crude oil and tools. Murdoch says white-collar crime's also a persistent problem. Some people have been caught embezzling money by issuing checks for non-existent employees. Others bill the company for hours they didn't work, and by the time the discrepancies are discovered, the suspects may be long gone. I'm Lauren Madelon in Midland, Texas.
Despite depressed oil prices, a Dallas-based company is planning to build two large natural gas pipelines in West Texas. Marfa Public Radio's Travis Bubenik reports the pipelines would export gas from the Permian Basin across the border to Mexico.
Energy Transfer already owns pipelines across the state and the country. Now it's won a contract from Mexico's Electricity Commission to bring gas from the Permian down south across the border. One of the pipelines would stretch from near the towns of Monahans and Pecos down through the Marfa area to Presidio. The other would run from the Permian west to the border near El Paso. Together, the company says the pipelines could transport about 2.8 billion cubic feet of natural gas a day. Energy Transfer's CEO, Kelsey Warren, who also owns the Lajitas Resort near Big Bend National Park, talked about the project's timeline on an earnings call.
We're very excited about our business south to Mexico. These next two projects that we were winners on, we're really both of them to come on in the first quarter of 2017. And we are finalizing the negotiations, and everything is on track to that timeline.
Some West Texans are worried about how the pipeline's construction would impact roads and the environment, while some people across the border are wary of selling their land for development on the Mexican side. Energy Transfer is also looking to expand its holdings in South Texas and other parts of the basin. In West Texas, I'm Travis Bubenik.
Gas and oil production in the Eagle Ford Shale has produced a windfall for the Texas economy. Along with it, hazardous roads for drivers. Local officials say they need the legislature to help keep up with repairs. Texas Public Radio's Eileen Pace went to DeWitt County to see what drivers are facing on the roads.
I'm noticing the edges are kind of rough.
Yes, ma'am. You can see where they break off. The roads are so narrow because they were originally gravel roads and they were really just built for passenger cars.
I'm traveling down the county roads in DeWitt County with Commissioner Curtis Afflerbach. Just a couple of years ago, the heaviest vehicle the roads had to support was a one-ton pickup hauling a trailer full of cattle. Then fracking in the Eagle Ford Shale intensified.
Well, they're bringing in the limestone, so you have the gravel trucks. And then, of course, then you have your big rigs that actually move your drilling rig in. Then you have the trucks that service the rig, haul all the pipe.
While Eagle Ford production has been great for the economy, it's been devastating to the roads. Big rigs fly down narrow two-lane country roads. Chunks of asphalt crumble off, leaving an obstacle course of deep craters. The edges of many of the roads are so shredded, the sharp-edged pavement can unexpectedly drop off half a foot. The state anticipates the annual cost for maintenance for roads in oil and gas fracking counties at $2 billion a year. And that's each year for the next two decades. And the roads are dangerous. According to LaSalle County Judge Joel Rodriguez, 60% of fatalities in 2013 on the state's farm-to-market roads came out of the seven most active fracking counties. Harlan Fuchs is the assistant chief of the West Off Volunteer Fire Department.
Especially out here on that Cheapside Road, it's murder. You're taking your life in your own hands.
When Fuchs responds to fires, he either drives down the center of the road or, if there's enough right-of-way, alongside.
You just bounce all over the road. Like I say, you try to go down the bar ditch. Hopefully, you know, it's a whole lot smoother down the middle of the bar ditch than it is on some of these roads.
In the last legislative session, Carlos Uresti, the Democratic senator for many of the fracking counties, carried a bill that provided $225 million for counties for road repair.
For the first time that anyone can remember in decades, where the state funded the county roads. That's always been a county function. County, you're on your own. But again, given all the activity going on in the Eagle Ford, I was able to get my colleagues to agree to pass this bill.
But Uresti says still more is needed.
Now, it only provided $225 million. But again, it was a great first step because it had never been done. And two, the counties just gobbled it up. But it's just a drop in the bucket. We're going to need more funding to keep these roads from falling apart.
DeWitt County Judge Darrell Fowler agrees. There are a lot of people trying to solve this problem. Some oil and gas companies have helped pay for the roads. Fowler joined with some of the counties to hire a lobbyist to press for more money. And he has another strategy, a bill that gives counties the mineral rights under county roads. He says it's oil money that now goes to the state,
with nothing coming back to the county of origin. And if we were any other property owner, we would by rights have the right to lease those minerals for oil and gas production.
Fowler is working with Houston Representative Garnet Coleman, whose urban colleagues represent 80% of the vote in the Texas House. Fowler also has the support of Senator Uresti, who will try to convince fellow lawmakers who don't represent Eagle Ford counties that fixing their roads helps the lucrative oil and gas industry and helps the people who live there.
And they don't care what they're doing, how much they're tearing up. And I'm scared to get on the roads around here.
Eileen Pace, Texas Public Radio News.
That's Texas Public Radio's Eileen Pace reporting. DeWitt County Judge Darrell Fowler tells Eileen he's been lobbying Texas lawmakers and thinks he has support for legislation that would keep mineral rights money in the county where it can be used to repair the roads. Judge Fowler says members of the County Judges and Commissioners Association of Texas are putting their muscle behind the bill. Oil pipeline plans in New Mexico face the same road hazard problems, but does the prospect of jobs outweigh the cost of environmental damage?
And they got a lot of cousins, nephews, brothers, and they want that line to go by because they do need to work.
That story on the legacy of a pioneering Tejano next on Fronteras. Welcome back to Fronteras. I'm Joey Palacios with Texas Public Radio. For more than eight decades, companies have drilled for gas in the San Juan Basin. Thousands of miles of gas pipelines cross northwestern New Mexico. But as KUNM's Laura Paskis reports, plans to transport crude oil out of the same area are raising questions about new development.
If you've tried to pull off U.S. Highway 550 near Lybrook in the past few months, you've probably had to wait a while. There are more than 50 new oil wells being drilled in this immediate area, and it is busy, especially as the oil is loaded into semi-trucks headed to markets.
What we know is that from the production that's there now, there's a better way to be able to gather it, collect it, and move it. And so that's how we base our business plan.
David Way is the chief operating officer of Saddle Butte Pipeline, based in Durango, Colorado. His company would like to build a pipeline that would run 130 miles from Lybrook down to the rail lines near Grants along Interstate 40.
We look at this as a great opportunity to minimize the risks from trucking, a great opportunity to be able to move crude oil in the safest possible way.
Local residents agree the roads are being chewed up. They say the oil workers drive too fast, and they worry about school buses sharing those roads. But they're worried about more than the traffic. Last month, almost 150 people squeezed into a Santa Fe meeting on the Pinyon Pipeline. Adding another 130 miles of pipeline to the thousands of miles already out there might not seem like such a big deal, but the Pinyon Pipeline would be one of the first crude oil pipelines in northwestern New Mexico.
I'll keep my comments as close to the technical as possible.
Rebecca Proctor is an archaeologist.
But I don't want anyone here to think that that means that I don't understand the incredible potential for destruction to the things that I've spent my life trying to understand, explore, and protect.
Some Navajo people, many who drove 150 miles to attend the meeting, spoke passionately against the pipeline and development. But a few, welders, members of Pipeliners Union Local 798, they say they want the pipeline.
I live like 5 miles where this line's going to lay,
and I got a lot of cousins, nephews, brothers, and everybody that lives nearby, and I had to talk with them and all, and they want that line to go by because they do need to work.
The pipeline's igniting so much interest, in part because for some, it's not just about one pipeline. The feeling is, if the pipeline's built, oil drilling will take off before it's properly regulated. Victoria Barr is with the U.S. Bureau of Land Management's Farmington Field Office. She says they got 7,400 comments on the pipeline.
We certainly appreciate all the public comments that we receive, and we read through them. I think it's great that so many people want to be involved.
They'll take more comments this summer and then look at how the pipeline might affect wildlife and the landscape. Then the BLM will decide either to approve the pipeline or to do more studies. Right now, Saddle Butte's David Waite can't say how much the pipeline might cost or who the investors are.
The rest of that's just going to have to come downstream in the process. This is just the beginning of the process.
The BLM's Victoria Barr emphasizes that too. But she says people should remember the BLM has a multi-use mission. It has to make way for people and wildlife and power lines, oil and gas development, and sometimes pipelines. I'm Laura Paskus, reporting from Santa Fe, New Mexico.
You've heard of Stephen F. Austin and Jim Bowie. This week at the State Cemetery in Austin, officials are dedicating a monument to another hero of Texas independence the public knows less about. Texas Public Radio's Ryan Poppy has more on why many believe this recognition of Jose Antonio Navarro is overdue.
At the corner of Market and Laredo Street in downtown San Antonio, tourists follow the arrows on a sign that point to internationally known tourist attractions, including the Alamo. There's also a lone arrow pointing in the opposite direction that fewer follow. It directs visitors to the home of a Mexican who helped write Texas's first constitution. Emiliano Calderon helped manage the historic site that used to be the home of Jose Antonio Navarro. It's where he spent his final years practicing law and serving in the state legislature after playing an important role in the fight for statehood. Calderon says the two-room whitewashed caliche home is in a neighborhood once known as Little Laredo. It connects the timeline between Spanish rule and Texas independence.
The missions were active during Navarro's time, and then while the Battle of the Alamo, which, you know, Navarro's in Washington on the Brazos signing the Texas Declaration of Independence. So he has an interesting role, and the site has a very interesting story to tell because it focuses on something that the missions in the Alamo and even the Spanish governor's palace doesn't really hit on.
While Navarro County is named after him, biographer David McDonald says the legacy of this lawyer and public servant is often overshadowed by the larger-than-life heroes who fought at the Alamo, including his nephew Jim Bowie and William B. Travis.
Later years, it was assumed in the point of view of Anglo-Americans who wrote Texas history that the real Texas history began with Stephen Austin's colonization project and especially with the Battle of the Alamo. What happened prior to that, in which there were Tejano people in Texas, they were considered to be bit players. And Navarro fell in within that group. He just wasn't included in the histories.
Navarro wasn't at the Alamo or any other battlefield at the time. A leg injury during childhood barred him from combat. He did fight with his pen, his influence, and his words. He was just one of three Mexicans to sign the Texas Declaration of Independence. McDonald says his role as the only Hispanic delegate to the state's 1845 Constitutional Convention is noteworthy.
As they proceeded through the various aspects of the Constitution, they came to the point of who could vote. And it was presumed by a lot of people that one proposed simply that to vote you'd have to be white. Jose Antonio Navarro objected strenuously to this.
Navarro prevailed, and the new constitution gave Tejanos the right to vote. Later, as a state legislator, he also fought against laws that were being used to confiscate Tejano land. Navarro's great-great-great-granddaughter, Sylvia Navarro Tillotson, has long hoped that his accomplishments would get wider recognition. Then 4 years ago, she had an idea when she visited the Texas State Cemetery in Austin.
And I saw that there were many Texas heroes that were buried there. And Austin's monument is there. And Navarro was a close friend of Stephen F. Austin, a confidant of his. They were very close. And I wondered why Navarro wasn't buried there. So that was the beginning of the idea of having a monument in his honor.
Navarro's remains will stay in San Antonio, but Tilson says the Friends of Casa Navarro raised more than $50,000 to place a cenotaph honoring him at part of the state cemetery where 14 other signers to the Texas Declaration of Independence are memorialized. The bronze bust of the patriot sits atop a marble pillar that's inscribed with many of his accomplishments.
When they read and know a little bit about Navarro's history, they will know about his love of freedom, his love for Texas, the sacrifice that he made personally for those freedoms, for all people.
Tilton hopes the recognition in Austin will spur the curious to learn more about her remarkable ancestor, and perhaps the next time they're at Market and Laredo Street in San Antonio, they'll follow that lone arrow to Casa Navarro, where his writing helped tell his story and the story of other early Tejanos. Ryan Poppy, Texas Public Radio News.
And that's it for Frontera. Send our stories from the Southwest this week. You can find the show at tpr.org under the Programs tab. Our producers are Shelley Koffler and Alexis Yancey. Chidanga Cakewalk composed this theme music. I'm Joy Palacios with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, Texas.